Greetings, brethren, on this day of Pentecost. Now, we're gathered here to observe the day of Pentecost, and we want to be sure we're observing the correct day for Pentecost. Because of the confusion that has occurred in the past, we find that Pentecost is being observed on different days, in fact, even on different weeks. So let's look at the two major issues that I would like to cover today. And I think we can demonstrate quite plainly why this day is the correct day. We want to look at the Pentecost change from a Monday to a Sunday, and then we want to look at the Pentecost count, which actually, with some groups, begins 1 week earlier than what it normally has been. Now, first of all, let's establish some facts about Pentecost. We know that we're looking particularly here now at observing the correct day, that is it a Sunday or is it a Monday? And we can look historically at the three major Jewish sects that we have historical references to regarding Pentecost, that is the marker for beginning the count toward Pentecost. And all Jewish parties agreed that the count for Pentecost began after the first holy day, during the days of unleavened bread. Now that didn't mean, of course, that they understood the truth about counting from the weekly Sabbath as the Sadducees did, because we know that the Pharisees used the first holy day as the marker, and the Colossians, an Ethiopian sect, used the last holy day as a marker, and then the Sadducees, of course, used the weekly Sabbath. But all of them agreed that the count for Pentecost begins after the first holy day during the days of unleavened bread. Now that may not really seem significant at this point because we're talking about either a Sunday or Monday, but you will see a little bit later on it is important. Here's an interesting comment you'll find regarding the Sadducees and the Pharisees going back to the reign of Antiochus VII. Remember, that area was controlled by these various groups who were divisions of the Greco-Macedonian Empire, because it split into four divisions after the death of Alexander, and this line of Antiochus kings was from this group that had taken over Asia Minor. And Antiochus VII reigned from 125 to 96 BC. And Josephus makes this statement: when Antiochus had erected a trophy at the river Lycus upon the defeat of Endates, the general of the Parthians, so they were at war with the Parthians at that time, he remained there 2 days at the request of the Jew Hyrcanus. Now, Hyrcanus actually was the high priest and king of the Jews who died in 106 BC, so it would certainly correspond to this same time period. At the request of the Jew Hyrcanus, because of an ancestral festival on which it is not lawful for Jews to travel. And he did not speak falsely in saying this, for the Pentecost festival had come following the Sabbath, and it is not permitted us to journey either on the Sabbath or on a festival. Now that's Josephus' statement. Now there's a rather interesting comment here in the Clinic and Strong's Encyclopedia. The comment is, the friendly ruler referred to here is Antiochus VII, not to be confused with the hated Antiochus IV, who was Epiphanes of the Maccabees story. In other words, this was later, a later time. Thackeray notes that in this tale, the Pentecost falls on the day after the Sabbath, as is always the case in the view of the Pharisees. See, in other words, it's a Sunday. Whereas the more literal biblical interpretation, see, now listen to this, the more literal biblical interpretation of the Sadducees, the festival could fall on any day of the week. Now see, stop and think for a moment about that. If it always fell on a Sunday, then it had to be calculated from a variable date. But if it fell any day of the week, it had to be calculated from a fixed date. And the only variable date that you would have within the days of unleavened bread would be the weekly Sabbath, because both the first high Sabbath day and the last high Sabbath day are fixed dates. So he therefore suggests, this comment goes on to say, that the observance probably of the Pharisees indicates the influence of the Pharisees during Hyrcanus' reign. Now you see, if he died in 106 BC, you see the Pharisees were quite prominent then. But then let's notice what happened here. Josephus reports that Hyrcanus abolished the rules of the Pharisees. This is Antiquities 13:10-6. Now, if you understand what happened historically, Hyrcanus had been a Pharisee and he turned against them. And the Pharisees were the ones who were elevated. And if you will recall, it was during the time of Christ, See, this was 106 B.C., so 100 years before the time of Christ, approximately at that time, a little before that time, they were demoted and the Sadducees were given the proper control, and they controlled it during the time of Christ, which meant that they calculated Pentecost from the weekly Sabbath. Now, there really is a clincher to this in the use of the word Sabbath. Because if you'll go to Leviticus chapter 23 and verse number 15, you will read, "And you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath." See the "the"? All right, keep that in mind. "From the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete, even unto the morrow after the," you see the word "the" there, "seventh Sabbath shall you number 50 days." Now, in these two cases here, where you see the word "the Sabbath," that's the Hebrew word using the definite article, ha Shabbat. In Hebrew, the word for "the" is ha. It's like Greek, when you don't have a definite article and there's no article listed there, it's automatically regarded as indefinite, such as a and an. But when you use "the," it is the Sabbath. Now, what you'll find in examining this word, "the Sabbath," every place it's used in the Bible, and I mean every place, you will find that it only refers to the weekly Sabbath. It never refers to a high Sabbath day. So it makes it very clear here that the Sabbath being referred to here is the weekly Sabbath. So therefore, the account for Pentecost begins on the day following the weekly Sabbath. Now there's something else that we need to realize. The change that was made in 1974 was based on the Hebrew numeration rule. And that rule states that whenever "me," the preposition "me," is used with respect to time, the count is always inclusive. In fact, they made that particular change. I told one of the doctrinal committee members down there that you made the change on the basis that "men," when used with time, is always inclusive. Now, I was also told, because what I'm going to point out to you here in the next few minutes is that as it is counted by some, it can be either inclusive or exclusive. They counted inclusive at the beginning and exclusive at the end. Now, what do I mean by that? Okay, I'll show you. You read here in Leviticus 23, verse number 15, "You shall count unto you from the morrow." You see the word "from the morrow"? That's "me mahorot." All right, now what's important is, go down to verse number 16, and you'll see "even unto the morrow." You see "unto the morrow"? That's also "me mahorot." Now what I've done in my Bible is I have "from the morrow" circled in verse 15, and I have "unto the morrow" circled in verse 16. I have a line drawn between the two of them, and I have the figure 50 written down. Now, according to the Hebrew numeration rule, whenever "me mahorot" is used with time, then that makes the count inclusive. Now, what does that mean? That means that if it is the morrow after the Sabbath, which would be Sunday, then that day is day one of the count. Now, if it's inclusive, if it's always inclusive, then you go down to verse number 16 and it says, "even unto the morrow," if that's "me mahorot," then that word has to be inclusive too. So what does that mean? That means that 50 days have to be completely counted before the count of Pentecost is completed. If you keep Pentecost on Sunday, you're only counting, you're actually doing the same thing the Jews do. They admit they only count 49 days. The count has to be complete in order to complete this number 50 here. Because notice what it says here. "You shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. Even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath shall you number 50 days." So you can't have it both ways. You can't arbitrarily say that it's inclusive, that is, you count Sunday as one, but it's exclusive at the end, so you don't count the 50th day. Yet that's what some people say. Now that's completely arbitrary. Why change the day then, if that's the line of reasoning? What you're simply admitting there is you just change it on the basis of a whim and what you thought it was, rather than following the actual technical Hebrew description. So if you understand it properly, then you have a full 50-day count before you keep Pentecost. Therefore, Pentecost is on Monday. One other thing I might call to your attention, and that is, Here's one of the three major holy days of the year. You have the Passover, Days of Unleavened Bread, you have Pentecost, and you have the Feast of Tabernacles. And yet you don't have a preparation day for Pentecost. That doesn't seem to make much sense. Now, I've checked every scripture in the Bible, in the Old Testament, where Mimahorat is used. And it's used two ways. The vast majority of them, and there are only two times out of this, I haven't actually counted this number here, but it looks like there's a couple dozen of them here anyway. Every single one of them, except two, refer to 24 hours later. But two of them refer to the morning following that night. That's in Genesis 19:34 and Judges 21:4. So we see very plainly that if it is going to be defined as the morning following that night, it's very clear in the scriptures. You can check those two texts. I won't take the time to turn to them. Genesis 19:34 and Judges 21:4. They show you very plainly it's the following morning. But all the others very plainly show it's the next day. So it shows you that the count for Pentecost begins on Sunday and ends on Sunday, a full 50-day count. Now there's one other thing. I mentioned this in the past, and I won't take the time to turn to all the scriptures now. I'll just quote them, read them. I'll quote them to you, and then you can check them out if you so desire. But you have here in Leviticus 23, you have the statement, "You shall count unto you from tomorrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete, even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath." So we have a min here in from the morrow in verse 15, so look at it there very carefully, have your Bible open there, and look in Leviticus 23, 15, and you'll see "you shall count unto you from the morrow," so that's min, Mimahorat. And then you have down in verse 16, "you're to count even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath." And you see the word even? That's the Hebrew word odd. So you have min and odd used together. Now when min and odd are used together, you will find the usage here in the Bible. In fact, one very good example here is back in Exodus. I don't want to take a lot of time at this because I covered it during the Passover season. It's Exodus 12, verse 18. "In the first day of the 14th month, at even," it's talking about the Passover, "you shall eat unleavened bread until the 1 20th day of the month at even." So here's this odd again used here for the word "until." Now, if you read this over carefully, it's talking about eating it from when? You start it at the 14th day, and then you eat it until the 21st day. Now, since it explains elsewhere that the 7 days are inclusive, that it is a complete 7-day period, then what you really see here is when it's talking about the 14th day at even, it's, that is the very end of the 14th day, as the 15th day is beginning, and then until the 21st day of the month at even, that's the end of the 21st day, a full 7 days. Now, these scriptures here, jot these down. This is 1 Samuel 8, 8. And 12:2, Jeremiah 3:25, Numbers 14:19, Exodus 10:6, 18:31, 1 Samuel 30:17, 1 Kings 18:26, and Genesis 46:34. Those will all show you that whenever odd is used with min is used with odd, then it's a full, the count is complete. In other words, it brings you up to a point in time, but that time doesn't mean that the very moment that point is mentioned, that's the end of the count, because the day there is involved is also included in it. All right, I think that gives you enough on that. Now let's go to the next thing here that we want to cover. And that is the Pentecost change to 1 week early. Now, why do I mention that to you? Because this year was one of those years when the Passover occurs on the Sabbath. And so the idea is that when the Passover occurs on the Sabbath, then Pentecost should be kept on May 27th. Now, we're not keeping Pentecost on May 27th. We're keeping it on June the 4th. Well, why is it being kept by some on May 27th, because of what Joshua 5, 10, and 11 say. Now let's go back and notice this here. We read here, the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at even in the plains of Jericho. Now, we know that they came out of the Jordan River, that is, they crossed the Jordan River, as you read back here in Joshua 4, verse 19, on the 10th day of the first month. So on the 10th day, they crossed the river and they came to Gilgal. Now, where was Gilgal? Gilgal was in the flat plain just west of the Jordan River before they got to Jericho. That's where they set up their camp. They set up the tabernacle there, and that was actually a center for the tabernacle for many years during the conquest. A lot of people don't realize this, but the tabernacle, that is the temporary one that Moses was instructed to build in the wilderness, that tabernacle moved several places over a period of time, four or five different locations was it located throughout the years before the temple was actually built in Jerusalem. So it was located at Gilgal, you remember? Saul went down to Gilgal and Samuel told him, wait until I come. But he didn't wait and offered the sacrifices before that time. That was at Gilgal. So this is where they had their headquarters. Now, they were at Gilgal, so they kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at even in the plains of Jericho. And they did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes and parched corn in the selfsame day. Now, we have originally thought for some period of time, and I'm not saying here that that is not altogether a valid conclusion, but we had felt for some period of time that this was referring to the second year, that is the second Passover, that is the second Passover that the number that the provision for the Bible makes in Numbers 9. That's quite possible. There's one argument against that, however, though, and that is when you go back over here to Joshua chapter 5, and we read here, beginning in verse 2, at that time the Lord said to Joshua, make these sharp knives and circumcise again the children of Israel a second time. Why? Verse 4, all the people that came out of Egypt that were males, even all the men of war died in the wilderness after they came out of Egypt. Now all the people that came out were circumcised, but all that were born in the wilderness by the way as they came forth out of Egypt, them they had not circumcised. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness. Now, what does that tell you? Well, you remember the curse that God placed on them. Everyone from 20 years and on up was to perish in the wilderness. So if this is 40 years later, then the youngest ones had just died and they weren't over 60 years of age. So what you have is you had all the ones that were over 60 that died, and then you have those who were born in the wilderness, 20 years of age when they left Egypt. They had been not doomed to destruction. So what you're looking at is you're looking at a sizable number there that had been circumcised and a sizable number that had not been. Now, people have made an estimate of how many could possibly have been involved here. And it's been estimated that all the people that came out were circumcised, but all that were born in the wilderness, by the way, them they had not circumcised, you're looking at a total mass of about 300,000 people here. So the argument is, not all of them would have been incapacitated because there would have been a number of them who had been circumcised. And they could have gone and fought against Jericho. That certainly is a possibility. Whatever the case is, we don't want to lay that completely aside. That certainly is a consideration that this was a second Passover. But there's another thing we need to look at that has been either ignored or overlooked. So let's notice some of these. First of all, the word wave sheaf is not even mentioned anywhere in the book of Joshua. I'll tell you what the belief here regarding this Joshua 10 and 11 is. That the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at even in the plains of Jericho, and they did eat the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover. Now you remember, we'll go back and notice this in a little bit, but the law stated they could not eat any of the produce of the land until the wave sheaf had been offered. And yet here they're eating the corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover. So the assumption is that that has to be referring to the wave sheaf day. So consequently, if that's the wave sheaf day, then the count for Pentecost is calculated on the Sabbath before then. That is, the Sabbath before then is picked as a marker. Remember now, if the Passover falls on the Sabbath, see, the Passover is not within the days of unleavened bread. So if it falls on the Sabbath, and that's the marker, then that makes the wave sheaf day this Sunday here the first day of the count. And if that's the case, then that's going to make the Feast of Pentecost fall a week early. That's why it's calculated as May 27 by many groups. Now we want to take a look at this. Is this really what it's saying? If this is what Joshua 5 is really talking about, then they'd certainly have a valid point. But is it talking about that? All right, we have one option. We have the option that we're looking at the second Passover. Now there's another one we need to look at. And that is this. God's requirements for offering the wave sheaf preclude the possibility of offering that which Israel had not sown or reaped. Now, what do I mean by that? Okay, let's go back here and notice Exodus. This is very important because this has actually been overlooked. Exodus 23 and verse number 14. Exodus 23, 14. Three times shall you keep a feast unto me in the year. Thou shalt keep the feast of unleavened bread. So we know what that is. And then notice what it says here. And the feast of harvest, verse 16. The feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors. So this is a feast of first fruits. That's Pentecost, isn't it? But notice what it says here. Which you have sown in the field. Which you have sown. Now, when they went over to Gilgal, and they camped in the plain there, had they sown those crops? No, they hadn't. Notice, we'll see here in just a moment. It says the first fruits of your land. It doesn't say the first spoils. So the feast of the harvest, the first fruits of your harvest, which you have sown in the field. So that's talking about the feast of first fruits. And the feast of ingathering, which is referring to the feast of tabernacles. So what is it? The first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field. That's a very important point that has been overlooked. And then verse number 19. The first of the first fruits of your land shall you bring into the house of the Lord. So the first of the first fruits of the land. Now if it's the first of the first fruits of the land and it had to be what they sowed, then it has to be their crop, not someone else's crop. That's an important point. Now go forward to Leviticus chapter 23. And we will note here what it says, the instruction here regarding the wave sheaf. Beginning here in verse 10, Leviticus 23, verse 10. Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when you be come into the land which I give unto you, and shall reap of the harvest thereof, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest. Now let's go back and notice it very carefully. When you come into the land which I give unto you. Now let me ask you this question. They came into the land all right, just barely, because Gilgal was not that far from the Jordan River. Had they produced and grown any crops? How could they? They'd only gone in on the 10th day, and here the Passover is the 14th. So when you be come into the land which I give unto you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then shall you bring a sheaf of the first fruits. Notice it says first fruits, not first spoils. Of your harvest. Your harvest. Not someone else's harvest. Unto the priest. And he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted of you on the morrow after the Sabbath. That's Sunday, but the day you count from, the marker is the weekly Sabbath, not either one of the two high Sabbath days. That's an important point to keep in mind. Now Leviticus 25, verse number 22. Leviticus 25, verse number 22. This shows you something I'm going to point out in just a few minutes here, that it certainly was feasible for them to have eaten grain the old stores of grain as a regular food commodity. Because it says here, you shall sow the eighth year and eat yet of the old fruit until the ninth year. So it certainly could be kept over. We all know how well grain can be stored. Now, let's notice something else here. Grain from pagan fields as an offering to God is certainly not acceptable. Notice Leviticus chapter 22 and verse number 24. You shall not offer unto the Lord that which is bruised or crushed or broken or cut, neither shall you make any offering thereof in your land. Neither from a stranger's hand shall you offer bread of your God in any of these, because their corruption is in them. Now does that sound like they could have come to the very first, Christ representing the first of the first fruits, and offer that offering from pagan grain when God forbade it? That's another important point to keep in mind. Going forward here to Leviticus 23, verses 10 and 11, see, what did we read here? It's your harvest. It's the first fruits, not the first spoils. So what does that indicate? What that indicates here is that Joshua 5, verses 10 and 11, is not talking about the wave sheaf day. It's talking about something else. And we'll take a look at that in a few minutes. So we've seen that the wave sheaf offering had to be the first fruits, Leviticus 23:10. And then we've also seen in Exodus 23:16. Let's notice it here once again, Exodus 23 and verse 16, that it had to be the first fruits of your labors which you have sown. So Jericho's crops were not the crops of the Israelites. All right, now that's an important point to keep in mind. Now, the next thing we need to realize is that the wave sheaf was to be offered after Israel had possession of the land. Because, you see, back in Leviticus 23:10, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you be come into the land which I give unto you. They were just really, for all practical purposes, on the border of the land. Just over. They certainly did not have possession of the land. They did not have possession of the land for some time after that. Remember the conquest of Joshua. That took several years. So they possessed the land after they did get possession of it. They didn't have possession of it when they entered it. And eating of the produce could not take place before the wave sheaf offering. That is the produce of the land that they had produced, that they had sown and produced. Because as you read here in Leviticus 23:14, you shall eat neither bread nor parched corn nor green ears until the selfsame day that you brought an offering to God. It shall be a statute forever throughout all your generations. That's the wave sheaf day. So that had to come first. Now, let's go back to Joshua chapter 5 again. And we'll notice here, it said in verse 11, they did eat of the old corn of the land. Now, most of the other translations just say produce. They don't say old corn. But Strong has an interesting comment on that. He says that word is used there only for stored grain. Now, if it's old corn, where did it come from? Well, they were over east of the Jordan River for a number of years, weren't they? Is it possible they looted any stores that were in the general vicinity of Gilgal? It's quite possible. So we're talking about old corn here. That is from the previous year, not the produce that had just come up. So remember, they could not eat the produce until the wave sheaf had been offered. Now, if they were forbidden in God's law to offer that which had belonged to the Gentiles and they'd taken from them, that was defiled, they certainly would not have been offering old produce from the land. It had to be from what they had produced. And they weren't producing anything at that point. Had they looted stores east of the Jordan River? Probably. They were over in that area for 40-some years. Did they have anything left from over there? It's quite possible. We don't know. But you see, we were told very specifically back in Leviticus 23, when they were in the land and they had possession of the land, that's what they offered the wave sheaf from. Now we should say one thing here once again. Would a wave sheaf from pagan grain represent Christ? Would pagan produce from the land be a proper representation? Not likely. Very unlikely. And we've seen here that the grain that Israel ate was old grain, not new grain. So we read here, they did eat of the old corn on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes and parched corn in the selfsame day. And the manna ceased on the morrow after they had eaten of the old corn of the land. Now that should tell us something here. Is it possible that this morrow, when they ate of the corn, was a daylight portion of the 14th? It's possible. It could be understood either way. The fact, however, is that they were eating the old corn of the land. There's no indication that they ate new produce that they had raised. They couldn't have raised it. And then what happened on that day? Neither had the children of Israel manna anymore, for they did eat of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year. Manna ceased at that time. So evidently they had access to stored greens on the west side of the river, all right. And they were eating that, but they certainly could not. If they were going to follow Moses' instruction in God's law, they would not have offered that as a first fruit offering to represent Christ, which they didn't understand at that time anyway. Now, here's something else. Notice Joshua chapter 1, verse 11, indicating that they certainly were eating old produce, eating grains that they had confiscated. In Joshua chapter 1, verse 9, well, let's pick it up in verse 10. This is just before they're entering into over across the Jordan River to Gilgal. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the host and command the people, saying, prepare you victuals, for within 3 days you shall pass over the Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God giveth you to possess. Prepare victuals. Now, this couldn't refer to manna. Why? Because manna spoiled in 24 hours. This was going to last 3 days. So where did these victuals come from? Quite obviously, from grains on the east side of the Jordan River. So there's no indication, see, that this produce was from a crop they grew when they crossed over the Jordan into the Holy Land. Now, another thing we need to realize here, when we look back at this command given here in Joshua chapter 6, the big city, of course, near there was Jericho. And we read here in Joshua 6, verse number 17, and the city shall be accursed, even it and all that are therein to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot save alive, she and all that are with her in her house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And you, in any wise, keep yourselves from the accursed thing, lest you make yourselves accursed, when you take of the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of brass and iron are consecrated to the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. So the only thing they could keep was what? Precious metals and important metal items. All the livestock was to be slain. Everything was to be slain. So it's not likely that they would have offered an offering to God out of anything from the environs of Jericho, which was very near them. All right, now let's notice something else here I think we need to look at carefully. I think this has been overlooked. It's rather significant, and it's probably been overlooked. And that is Joshua 5, verse 11. They did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes and parched corn in the self same day. Now the assumption is that the word self same day is just simply referring to that same day they ate it. Now we find something interesting in the Bible here regarding the usage of this word self same day. Here's every passage in the Old Testament where it's used. It's not even used in the New Testament, because there's only 1, 2, 3, four references where self same is used in the New Testament, but there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 in the Old. Now, when you examine the use of the word self same day, what you find is it has two meanings. It means the same day as the events are describing it. For example, Genesis 7:13, in the selfsame day entered Moses and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife, and three wives of his sons with them into the ark. That was the same day. It's used that way in every one of these cases, with the exception of two that are very clearly used otherwise, and in all probability, three when we look at Joshua 5 verse 11 carefully. Now let's go back and notice here. Self same day in Exodus 12. You might just want to hold your finger there in Joshua chapter 5, because we'll probably be coming back to it occasionally. I'm going to put my bookmarker in it right now. So let's go back here and notice Exodus chapter 12. And we'll see something very interesting. Exodus chapter 12. And we'll read here in verse number 40. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. Now people assume something. They read something into that. They're very careless in reading. It doesn't say that they dwelt in Egypt 430 years. It said the total length of the sojourn of Israel who dwelt in Egypt, simply saying that at a period of time they dwelt in Egypt, but the whole time of sojourning was 430 years. Now actually, the Septuagint, I think, has certainly got the concept of that correctly, and they translate it, the sojourning of the children and of their families, which they sojourned in the land of Canaan and in the land of Egypt, was 430 years. Actually, they were only 215 years in Egypt. Previous to that time, they were up in the land of Canaan. But now let's notice something very interesting here in verse number 41. It came to pass at the end of 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Now what is it talking here about the selfsame day? There isn't any reference to this being, it says 430 years, the selfsame day after 430 years. So it's referring to some event that's linking back to 430 years later, the selfsame day, this event. Something happened 430 years earlier. So that tells you very plainly that Exodus 12:41 refers to something other than that exact day being referred to, refers to some other event. And then you go to verse number 51 here in Exodus chapter 12, and you read, it came to pass that self same day that the Lord did bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their armies. Now what day was that? Well, it was the night of the 15th, wasn't it? That's when they left Egypt. Ha ha! Is that telling us something here about Joshua 5 now? If the Passover's on the 14th, we read they kept the Passover on the 14th. They did something on the 15th, the selfsame day. The selfsame day is what? The day they came out of the land of Egypt. So that's very significant. So we go back here to Joshua 5, verse 11. They did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched corn, in the selfsame day. What day? Well, if the verse 10 is referring to the 14th, then verse 11 has to be referring to the 15th. That's exactly when they left the land of Egypt, 40 years later. Well, now we have something else we have to consider. So if that's the case, then this is not referring to the Wave Sheaf Sunday at all. All right, now there's something else we need to look at here. Supposed discrepancy. And that is, here's what the discrepancy is. I'll call these to your attention here. We read here in Exodus 12, verse number 41, it came to pass at the end of 430 years, even the selfsame day. So we're talking about a 430-year period. So we're talking about something that occurred 430 years earlier. All right. Now, let us notice Genesis 15:13. What happened here in Genesis 15:13? Well, here was a strange event that took place. A lot of people haven't understood this very well because it is a part of the sacrificial system, and they don't really understand what was taking place here. But what it really is, it was a special type of an offering that was attached to an oath or a promise, making the person who made the promise duty-bound to keep it. So you read here, this event that's taking place here with Abraham in Genesis 15. It came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp, that is a lamp of fire or a flaming torch, that passed between those pieces. They took the sacrifice and they laid it out and divided it in half. And then whoever was making the oath went between those two pieces, and then between those two sections. It's a special type of offering. So this was a rather very, very unique situation because God was making a promise here, making an oath here to do something. So we read in verse 18, "In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, and from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates." God now made a promise to him. But notice what happened earlier in verse number 12 here. "When the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and a horror and a great darkness fell upon him." This is verse 12, Genesis 15, verse 12. "And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be stranger in the land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Now we have a 400-year period spoken of here. So the other one in Exodus 12 mentioned 430 years, but this mentions 400 years. "And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge." So we have a discrepancy here of 30 years. Well, we really don't have a discrepancy. What we're looking at is two separate things being spoken of here. All right, now let's go to Acts 7, verse number 6. Acts 7 and verse number 6. This is Stephen talking here, if you recall, at the time that he was witnessing to these religious leaders. And he quotes this scripture back in Genesis 15:13. "God spake on this wise," Acts 7, verse 6, "that his seed should sojourn in a strange land, that they should bring them into bondage and entreat them evil 400 years. So here's a 400-year period spoken of. Yet when you go to Exodus 12, verse number 41, you read, "It came to pass at the end of 430 years, even the selfsame day." So we have a 30-year difference here. We find the same thing here in the book of Galatians, chapter 3, and verse number 17. Let's turn to it here and note it. It says here, "This I say, that the covenant which was confirmed before of God in Christ," that it was confirmed to Christ, given to him, "the law, which was 430 years after, cannot disannul." So here's the 430 years spoken of from a given point of time. Now the question is, what is this given point of time? What are we talking about here? Well, there's several possibilities. Why is there this supposed discrepancy between the 400 years and the 430 years? Well, here's the possibilities. Genesis and Acts simply give round figures, some believe. In other words, they're just giving a round figure. It's all speaking the same event, but they're giving just round figure numbers. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Another possibility is that from the time of Abraham's call, that was 30 years before the birth of Isaac. So it's referring to the time Abraham was called, 30 years before the birth of Isaac. There's one thing wrong with that, however, and that is Abraham was called in his 75th year, and Isaac was born 25 years later. So there's a 5-year discrepancy there. So that's probably not the answer. And then the most likely answer is, going back here to Genesis 12, verse number 1, and I think this can be fairly well demonstrated, particularly when you use the Septuagint along with it. You read in Genesis 12, verse number 1 here, the Lord said to Abraham, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house into a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee. So God is really making a promise right then and there. So that's the time that Abraham left the land. Now, there are a number of commentators who have calculated this time period from here to the time Israel went out of the land of Egypt, and it's 430 years. That certainly is a possibility. We only have one other thing now that needs to be looked at here, and that is in Genesis 21 and verse number 8. When we're looking at this 400-year period, if this 400-year period is talking about another event, and it's not just round figures, what is a 400-year period? All right, we know that Isaac was born when Abram was 100 years old, 25 years after he received that original promise. But now there's an event that is described here, and you know, people have always wondered, well, what is the real significance of this event? And that is Genesis chapter 21, verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Agar, the Egyptian, which he had borne to Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son. Now this couldn't have been any little light thing. She wouldn't have gotten so upset she just demanded to kick her out of the whole household just because he was playing. Must have been quite serious. There must have been some real deep-seated resentment there. This was persecution against Isaac as a child. Now this was taking place, remember, the great feast the same day that he was weaned. Well, is it quite possible this is 5 years later? So that would make 30 years after the time Abraham left the land. Isaac was born 25 years later, and 5 years later when he was weaned, this is when this event took place. It's quite possible. Now people think, well, they usually wean children earlier. Well, I'm not so sure in this case here, because you look how long they lived. Their whole age differentiation was quite different than ours. And so it's quite possible that he was at this age being weaned. If that 400 years is talking about evil entreated, that's when it really began. That's quite possible. So, and notice especially, see, what we read back here in Acts 7. Once again, let's just touch on this very quickly, just to illustrate what I mean. God spake on this wise, Acts 7, verse 6, that his seed should sojourn in a strange land, and that they should bring them into bondage, and entreat them 400 years, beginning with that persecution against Isaac. Quite possible. So what is it really telling you here? I'd say the chances are very, very great. Now, can I say 100% positive and this is just absolutely it and this is the answer? I don't think anybody can say that. But I can certainly say that this is a possibility that's been overlooked. I do know one thing. It cannot be referring to the wave sheaf Sunday because it goes contrary to Moses' instruction about what could be offered. So it can't be referring to that. It's either got to be the second year, or it's not referring to the wave sheaf Sunday here at all, but it's referring to use the word self-same day. Now, if they came out on the self-same day, then they came out on the 40 years after the time Israel left the land of Egypt. And it's even quite possible they came out 430 years after the time that Abraham was given the promise and 400 years after the time the persecution began. It is not referring, however, to the wave sheaf offering. So the idea that the Pentecost count begins on the Sabbath prior to the days of unleavened bread is invalid. Now, if you stop and think for a moment here about the week you have the Passover falling on a Saturday. All right? That Saturday is not within the days of unleavened bread. So you remember what I told you earlier. All the Jewish parties recognized very plainly that the count could not begin until after the first holy day of the Days of Unleavened Bread. They never went outside of the Days of Unleavened Bread to begin the count. Therefore, the only Sabbath within the Days of Unleavened Bread is the last day of the Days of Unleavened Bread, which is Saturday. That would make the following day, then, Sunday, is day number one of the Pentecost count. That would make Pentecost, and if it's properly kept on Monday like it should, it would make it June the 4th. That's why we're here observing this day. Israel entered the land the self-same day, more than likely 430 years after the promised Abraham. And entering the land confirmed that covenant. That's why the word self-same day is used there. It's very significant. 440 years. Why did all of a sudden they come into the land and there they were very, very near the Passover, and here they were commemorating it on the Passover, and we're talking about the self-same day, the day they ate the produce of the land. So the account in Genesis 15:13, remember when the strange sacrifice was given and this flaming torch passed between them, which has to be a reference to God in a glorified form. That was certainly the ratification of the covenant by an oath. And it also forecast the 400 years of persecution. And then you had Genesis 15:18 ratifying this covenant then. And Genesis 22:17, because if you look in any marginal references, you will find that most likely when you see that text there in Galatians, and I haven't checked the one there in Acts 6, they refer back to this event here in Genesis 22. Remember when Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice and God stopped him? And then God said, "By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord." This is Genesis 22:16. "For because thou hast done this thing and hast not withheld thy son, thy only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies." What was that? Well, that was really a confirmation and an expansion of the blessings. The promise had already been given much earlier, on two separate occasions at least. So we see, by going through this thing in Joshua chapter 5 here, it's very, very unlikely, unless Israel just disobeyed God and went against Moses' instruction and God's instruction, this is not referring to a Wave Sheaf Sunday. It's referring to the commemoration of event when that covenant was given, and then they entered that land and confirmed it by eating the produce of the land on that day.